Welcome to Independence, the FIEC podcast. My name's Phil Topham, Executive Director of the FIEC, and it's time for our dive into the news. We've not done this for a couple of weeks, and I'm pleased to welcome John Stevens, our National Director. Morning, John.
Hi, Phil.
And our Head of National Ministries, Adrian Reynolds, is here as well. Good morning, Adrian. A good Easter, gentlemen.
Yeah, it was all right.
Well, that wasn't very quick.
Yeah, great Easter. I mean, so it's always good to remember that Jesus has risen.
Absolutely.
I do that every Sunday, John.
Well, we do, but it was, it was nice to take a little bit of time off.
Good. My car broke down, that's why I didn't.
There we are. But no, Christ is risen and we rejoice in that. This week's been a busy week for us. Adrian, you've just come back from Reading.
Yep, so our local conferences are underway. We've had a few this week. And yesterday I was in Reading with the folk there, looking at the subject, proving yourself, really important subject. It's quite... I mean, I've done two of these now, one in Leicester, one in Reading, and each time I'm convicted by it. I think by the time I get to number six, I'll be a wreck, probably emotional wreck, but really important subject actually for us to grapple with as leaders. So yeah, really happy time. Good just to hear really what we're hearing from lots of churches, which that people are being converted, churches are growing, sometimes in surprising ways. So leaders really are on the ground in local churches, generally in very good heart, and to hear of conversion growth, especially, really thrilling. To hear about, you know, a small church which is having multiple baptisms, all those sorts of things, very exciting.
Excellent. John, what have you been up to this week?
I've been largely in the office, actually, although on Tuesday I spent a day with the European Missionary Fellowship staff. I'm a trustee of the European Missionary Fellowship, and they got together kind of reasonably locally. So I was talking about the gospel vision for Europe, the need of Europe, why there's a real opportunity to be getting the gospel out into Europe. I do think that for British churches, we do need to see Europe as being a kind of a really important mission field for us. So 741 million people. I would say that if you look at where the greatest need is in the world in terms of unreached kind of groups, the Islamic world, Japan, and then kind of Europe comes next in terms of sort of very small numbers of Christians, the evangelical churches kind of not growing very fast. So despite all of the history, despite the appearance of being a kind of, you know, Christian heritage, actually the reality is immense gospel need across kind of Europe. And I think there's a real opportunity there for churches in the UK to sort of, in a sense, get engaged in sort of gospel work. There are good things going on. There are churches being planted, leaders being raised up. There's been significant gospel growth in France in the last 15 years. So there are encouragements, but it is still a massive need.
We want to talk a bit about your role in Affinity in a few minutes and their plans for a Gospel Coalition UK. We'll come to that. Just before we do, reminders, you can book for a local conference that's near you. Thrive and Ministry Wives, I believe there are still some places available on both of those conferences, but you need to contact us if you want to book. Bookings have closed on the website. There's one or two places left if Women in Ministry or Ministry Wives want to book for either of those at the end of this month. And of course, the Leaders Conference bookings are still open as well. And
will be get in
until October. So yeah, the early bird price, £235 until the end of June. He asked. Yeah, Joel has nodded. Like, excellent. Very good. I ought to know that by now. You've just checked on holiday myself.
So that's
right. There we are. So let's talk a little bit then, John, about time you spent with Affinity before Easter. Some stuff's come out this last couple of weeks. Affinity are exploring what it would mean to set up the Gospel Coalition UK. First of all, just give us an overview of why those discussions
have
been happening.
Can we just go back and say what Affinity is? Because I don't think everybody listening will necessarily know what Affinity is.
So FIEC is a constituent member of Affinity, which is a broad group of conservative evangelicals, both individual churches and larger groups. It's not just independents. So FIEC is a constituent body. So are some of the Presbyterian groupings in Britain, some of the Anglican groupings, etc., and also Christian charities as well. So like London City Mission and the like would be part of Affinity as well. So it's a broad umbrella of conservative evangelicals. So why is Affinity thinking like this? Why isn't what they're doing already giving that broad evangelical consensus? Why think about something called the Gospel Coalition UK?
Well, I think Affinity's been around for a long time. And as you said, it's a sort of a more conservative evangelical kind of gathering of a kind of churches, networks, denominational groups, and also kind of mission agencies and kind of bodies. It's been around. It was originally the British Evangelical Council. It then became sort of an Affinity. It's led by a group of trustees and a council of representatives of all of those different groups, probably about 25 or so people. And in many ways, what Affinity has been seeking to do is actually very much what a Gospel Coalition does. It has sought to be a meeting place around a core agreed doctrinal basis for mutual encouragement, standing together in the gospel. Graham Nichols is the director of kind of Affinity. They produce a variety of kind of resources and materials to help serve kind of church churches. So there's a sort of a theological journal that's published a couple of times a year. They hold a conference biannually. And actually, I think one of the main advantages of it is getting together that group of leaders and representatives from those different denominations, networks, and bodies. And actually, we spend 24 hours together twice a year. And that really does foster relationships and mutual understanding. So in many ways, Affinity has been doing exactly what a gospel coalition has sought to do on a smaller scale, and probably with less kind of recognition and less awareness. The very fact that we ask the question, what is Affinity, I think in a way highlights the problem that people don't really realize what Affinity kind of is. The desire has been to want to try to build and strengthen evangelical unity in those core gospel truths. And I think there's an awareness that there are people that are outside of the current Affinity family who would very much agree with Affinity's doctrinal positions and would stand with those, but they haven't, for whatever reason, felt that Affinity is the group that they want to kind of belong to.
Why would they join a gospel coalition then? If they wouldn't join Affinity, why would they join the gospel coalition?
Well, I think gospel coalition works slightly differently. So a gospel coalition isn't necessarily an organization in which individual churches and denominations belong to. It's more a kind of a group of leaders who've come together to stand together. So to some extent, a gospel coalition is slightly easier to connect with. It's a more recognized brand of what it's there and what it's there for. It has encompassed a kind of a slightly broader spectrum of philosophies of ministry than historically Affinity has done. So I think the Affinity Council has been thinking through how can we best serve that cause of bringing together like-minded people to be an encouragement to one another. And this has been done in a number of other places. So in Australia, for example, they've set up an Australian Gospel Coalition. In Canada, they've set up a Canadian Gospel Coalition, which actually have their own kind of distinct local flavors. This is not some American brand coming and imposing itself. It's actually developing something that potentially could serve the kind of the need within a particular kind of place. And so I think the council, having spent a lot of time discussing it and actually consulted extensively with leaders outside of Affinity who might be interested in the idea of something like a gospel coalition, there's been a lot of encouragement from some of those other leaders to say, yes, we think there's a real need to express evangelical unity, to bring leaders together so that we can develop that kind of mutual encouragement and stand together. And Affinity has felt that the next step is to sort of move on to a consultation with that wider group to see whether this really would serve the cause of the gospel more widely within the UK. So that's the decision that's taken.
It's worth saying as well, there is a gospel coalition called something different in Germany, in France.
Yeah.
In Germany, it's called Evangelion 21. So it's slightly different, but doing the same sort of thing. I guess, can I ask a difficult question?
Yeah.
This maybe is the elephant in the room. I mean, I've been on the Affinity Council, as you are on the Affinity Council. I remember those days with happiness. And I think one of my questions is that Affinity has always wanted to, but never quite been able to engage with evangelical Anglicans and with New Frontiers. Mm-hmm. Those are the two church groupings, if you like, that are conspicuous by their absence. And I don't want to go into the reasons necessarily why that is. But do you think there's a possibility that kind of a whatever it is, a rebrand, a relaunch, a kind of a shift towards Gospel Coalition would change that?
It may do, and that's some of the consultations and conversations that have got to be had. I mean, there are historic reasons for that. I think historically, Affinity, because of its identity as predominantly a nonconformist group, wasn't particularly welcoming to others outside of that world. So there was sort of historically perhaps a negative attitude towards Anglicans. In actual fact, that's already begun to change with Affinity. So groups have joined in recent years. So for example, Church Society is a member of Affinity, and Lee Gatiss is a member of the kind of council. There have been a kind of new agency groups like London City Mission has joined. So Affinity has already seen the beginnings of a gathering a wider group of evangelical organizations that have wanted to be part of that. We've spoken to evangelical Anglican leaders, and a number of those have said, yes, they think this is a good idea that is at least worth pursuing and worth discussing. Whether that leads to an active willingness to be involved, I think remains to be seen. That's one of the unknowns, and that's why there needs to be a process of kind of consultation and discussion. Similarly, attempts to reach out to some of the leaders within the New Frontiers kind of world. My hope is that even if it doesn't lead to a gospel coalition, it will lead to a better relationship with those who hold the same core doctrinal convictions in common. Certainly, I've benefited hugely from Affinity bringing leaders together and getting to know people who I would never have met, particularly from Scotland, Northern Ireland, Wales, different constituencies, some of the Presbyterian churches and denominations. There's just huge value in doing that. So I think The opportunity is there. The real question is whether or not those other groups will want to take advantage of an opportunity like this. But I think Affinity wants to approach this with a genuinely open-handed willingness to bring about something, which is not Affinity saying simply come and join us, but is saying, can we together create something that will serve the cause of a sort of a unity between conservative evangelicals within the UK? And even there, conservative's not the easy word. It's people who are kind of united in kind of core gospel kind of convictions, but they will have a spectrum of different kind of approaches to local church ministry.
Is it a done deal, or is this a very much a consultation? I think that's an important question.
Oh, no, it's absolutely a consultation, because a gospel coalition would be something new. It's not simply Affinity changing its name and saying we are the gospel coalition. I think because there are differences between them, although theologically almost identical, this would be something that would need to be brought about. And I think if there is not a desire for that on some of the other bodies that are in other countries where there is a gospel coalition have joined into a gospel coalition, if that weren't the case, then it's clearly not going to serve the gospel need. And as inevitably in these kinds of things, the response has been a kind of a mix of some people saying, yes, we're really enthusiastic about this. We want to see this kind of wider unity. Others saying, do we need this? There are some people who are skeptical of gospel coalition. They think it's somehow a kind of corrupted brand because of some things that have happened in the States. So no, absolutely not a done deal. But I think that the heart behind it is a desire to say, how do we serve the cause of gospel unity in the UK? And certainly, I think over sort of the past few kind of years, there's been less unity in evangelicals. I think that's because in the past, we relied on certain conferences to be the main meeting point of evangelicals coming together. And those are no longer serving that purpose. And kind of different networks have grown and strengthened and have got their own events. And actually, there's a missing place to meet together, both for leaders and for kind of churches more widely. And I think the question that's being asked is this might be a way of filling that need in a way that sort of serves the gospel, because we're all in the end really very small a kind of evangelicals, and we can easily just move only in our own streams and only in our own little corner of God's kingdom. And there is great benefit from recognizing that we are part of something much bigger.
We will watch it with interest. Thank you, John. Let's dive into
and pray, absolutely,
and
if you've got a view
and get involved, pray about
You know, get in contact with Affinity and let them know what you think.
Absolutely, but we will watch on and see where that lands. Let's move on to a massive news story this week, which has been the cast review. This is into gender identity, and particularly on the back of sort of the Tavistock Clinic and the way that children especially have been fast-tracked towards gender identity change and all that kind of thing. The cast review was absolutely excoriating, I think it's fair to say, about the paths that have been followed, essentially saying that ideology has trumped medical advice in lots of ways, and essentially making recommendations which will, if followed, move this kind of recommendation into a completely different area. It was a very, very interesting thing to read. You've both printed it out in full.
I printed it in A5.
Yes, to save a bit of money.
Paper. Yeah, I mean, it's you can't see this if you're listening, but it's a mummer of a report.
It's huge. It's huge, absolutely. Full of recommendations of how to do things differently. The one that I thought was most interesting was the recommendation that when children present like this, there should be a more holistic medical approach to how they are interacted with, looking at things like mental health, situations at home, or all of those things. That can only be a good thing, can't it?
Can we just go back one step?
You did this with the other story. Yeah,
well,
of course.
I think it's important here. There are people who have been very, very poorly served. You know, real people with real problems who have been very, very poorly served by the gender and identity services that have been provided. We need to be full of lament for that, I think. So let's come on to the recommendations and what the report says. But actually, there are some people who have been shabbily and worse than that, but very poorly treated, and have been done a great disservice by these services, or lack of services. And that's something both to lament and to pray into. I think it's a moment for grace as well as a moment for truth. And Peter Linus says that in his EA summary, which is a very helpful little summary, actually, if you want to read that. We'll put the link in the show notes. It is a moment for grace as well as a moment for truth. So but before we sort of jump onto it and talk about all the things we like about it and perhaps think where it doesn't go far enough, we just do need to acknowledge that some people have been very, very badly treated by just the poor services that have been provided.
Well, so just in general comment, you said it was excoriating. At one level, it is in terms of changing the processes that are adopted. At the same time, it's quite nuanced. So it does sort of say, and having dealt with all of the people who've been involved here, all of the practitioners, all of the different views, I mean, kind of Hilary Cass reaches the conclusion that everybody acted out of what they thought was the best interests of those that they were treating. And there's no doubt that here there was a massive social phenomena, a massive increase in transgenderism, and a hundredfold increase between 2009 and 2021 that totally overwhelmed the services that were provided. So you're absolutely right, the need for holistic care. But when you suddenly had a mass explosion of people wanting care and requiring very significant kind of therapy, consultations, etc., it suddenly becomes impossible to deal with that. And she makes the point that in many of these areas, there's simply no evidence base on which to determine treatment conditions. Now, that inevitably led to people operating from an ideological perspective or making judgments on the basis of very little kind of evidence. But she does recognize something of the challenge that was faced by practitioners of a massive explosion of demand, often with people coming with expectations of what they wanted, thinking they knew what treatment was right for them, plus the absence of any really significant evidence base as to what the implications of various treatment
and a very toxic
were.
I mean, she says it's a very toxic culture in terms of people discussing it. I'm just the stats. 2009, there were just about 60 referrals to JIDS, the Gender and Identity Service in the UK, for children and adolescents, just under 60, something like that. 2016, about 1,800. So, I mean, actually, in absolute numbers, they're still not enormous.
No, but it is an explosion.
Huge
from
explosion.
Where you were.
Yeah, as you all know from the press, you know, it's in our faces the whole time.
Yeah. The ideological point is interesting, though, isn't it? Because actually, a lot of young people have access to internet, social media. They are looking at all these kind of affirming videos, memes, etc. This is the route to go down. Influencers encouraging people down that route. And then in schools, we read that, you know, gender-affirming care is all the rage amongst school children, even at primary school age. That should worry us, shouldn't
and
it?
And powerful lobby groups.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, Stonewall being very powerful.
Yeah.
I mean, Wes Streeting just yesterday has apologised now for the part that he played. He worked for Stonewall. He's the Labour health shadow health secretary. He worked for Stonewall at the time. And of course, the very well-known mantra was that a trans woman is a woman. And actually, he's now rode back on that and said he's very sorry for that. And that wasn't right. So I think... You know, lobby groups like Stonewall have had a profound influence, not only in terms of gender provision, but actually in education, lots of other areas as well. And it's just, I mean, I think if you weren't angry about it and cross about it, you would have to admire actually how a very small group has had a very profound impact. But I think actually it is a cause for great sorrow and anger on the part of Christians.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, the report devotes quite a lot of time to asking the question, how did this phenomenon grow? Yeah, why was there such an explosion? And I think it's fascinating to see why that has kind of happened. Because, of course, for some, they'll say, well, it's just evidence that transgenderism was real and it was just not diagnosed and not acknowledged. I think the report recognises that to some extent the ideology causes people to interpret their experience in particular ways. And social media has had a huge impact in terms of doing that, in terms of, or in a sense, creating the idea that, you know, gender is fluid and that if you feel in certain ways, then that's an indication that you are transgender. And that's caused people to interpret themselves in a way that has then gone on to seek kind of treatment. But there are some underlying factors for that. So I think the report points out that the sort of the problem of kind of, in a sense, pigeonholing people into particular gender identities, that there's an irony that if we have very strong gender identities of what it means to be masculine and to be feminine, if people don't quite fit into what are those social stereotypes, then actually they draw the conclusion that they must belong to the other kind of gender, which I think is a really interesting kind of observation and actually quite significant for Christians.
Absolutely.
Because we can very easily kind of say that biological sex determines gender and then have a very culturally constructed model of what gender actually means, playing with particular toys, liking particular clothes, having certain personality traits. If we kind of take that very rigid view of what masculinity and femininity means, then actually we create the problem because people who don't fit that norm, well, how do they explain the fact that they don't fit that norm? Well, transgenderism is one way of explaining that. So I think that's just an example. I mean, another another that was hugely significant is the impact of pornography in terms of affecting people's understanding of kind of sex. And some shocking statistics about the ages at which people see extreme pornography and the impact that that has on people. So of the respondents to the survey, I think I was struck by a statistic that said that sort of 47% kind of basically sort of girls expected sex to involve sexual aggression. And 42% thought that girls enjoyed sexual aggression, including choking, which is obviously being created by pornography. Mm. Now, when that's the world in which young girls are growing up, if that's the norm of what heterosexual sex is presented as being, then it's not particularly surprising that there is a reaction against that. Now, we have to recognise that those are very important influences. Plus, the report makes... sort of brings together lots of evidence about the kind of plasticity of the brain and development during the whole period of puberty. So I think it's significant in terms of identifying some of those underlying causes, which are more social and ideological rather than rooted in any kind of sort of a biological or medical kind of issue. And that's been exposed by this report.
In a couple of minutes, I want to ask you both for advice for church leaders in this area. But before we do that, let's just link this to social media. So obviously social media has played a part in all of this ideology being spread across the country and through schools and across the nation. But interesting story this morning about social media. So WhatsApp have lowered their guidelines for age restrictions. So now they're saying it used to be 16, now it's 30. Story on the front page of the BBC website this morning saying children as young as 9 are being added to malicious WhatsApp groups. There's something else going on here, isn't there? People being pastored by their smartphones, essentially, and children being influenced by tablets and smartphones from a very, very young age. I've got profound concerns about this as a dad of a young daughter. How seriously should we be taking this in the church?
Well, I think we have to, I mean, we're all parents around the table. Not everybody listening will be a parent. I think one of the things we've got to do is we've got to help parents in the church know how to parent well. I think there is a shift in accessibility and availability that has come first of all through the internet. And then secondly, I think especially through smartphones, which puts the internet in your pocket. I don't want to downplay that. But I do also want to say that parents have always had to train their children to live in a non-Christian world, essentially. So I think that looks different in different stages. And I think that the moment we're facing at the moment is particularly intense, and the pressures are particularly kind of multiplied. But it's not entirely new. Mm. I think I just want to say it's not entirely new. So I think actually the things that if you were a Christian when you were younger that you were grappling with, probably in principle, underlying principle, there's some of the same issues. Mm. So, you know, in terms of, I'm thinking about the friends I had at school as a Christian and the, you know, colleagues in class, for example, and things they were looking at and talking about, that there were pressures as well. Mm. I think the internet and the availability of smartphones does make a quantitative difference. Yeah. So the accessibility is that much greater. But I think actually the parenting principles are unchanged. Talk about those a bit more if you want.
Accessibility is important though, isn't it? Because when I was a teenager, if I wanted to view that kind of material, there would have to be a whole process to go through before you even got anywhere near it. Whereas now it's just in someone's pocket.
Well, okay. Kids at my school all had porn.
Right.
In the 80s, they had a magazine at the bottom of their bag.
Yeah, okay.
And there'll always be the new thing that's reacting to the thing that went beforehand. So when television burst onto the scene, you could watch all sorts of stuff on television that wasn't available or that was more difficult to get hold of, and that influenced and changed people's thinking. I think one thing we can recognise is I do think it is a massive challenge, because social media and all of these sort of devices are wonderful. They open up great opportunities for connecting, forming friendships, for kind of organising, gathering together. My kids have appreciated those, and those have been hugely helpful. But then there's a whole load of other dangers. And what's really hard as a parent is policing it, because you don't necessarily know what your kids are watching. Obviously, the age at which you make smartphones available, but that could be made difficult by schools and others almost expecting that you have them to be necessary for doing kind of work as schools move on to kind of iPad and phone based kind of sort of systems.
Scan the QR code.
So you kind of get driven into that world. Although I think at the moment we should be encouraged that there is, I think, in wider society, an awareness of the dangers, increasing noises being made about the effect of social media, the effect of smartphones, some wanting to argue that smartphones should be banned, greater regulation of the companies and what's kind of available. And again, this is an area of new technology that's not been around for a long time, and its dangers are being increasingly identified. I mean, the whole move to want to have age verification for pornography is another kind of really positive step to control that. Those are reminders to us that just a free market of allowing people to do whatever they want here is ultimately deeply destructive. Mm. People need to be protected against how these devices can be misused and the companies that will sort of profit from kind of misusing them. So it's not massively different to other areas of life where something new is originally received and everybody becomes enthusiastic about it, and then the dangers are perceived and it begins to be increasingly regulated in the same way of, say, smoking. So things are changing, but it's a massively difficult thing to help children to be able to have access to those things that are needed and useful to them whilst protecting them from those things that are deeply dangerous. And I guess being honest with kids from an early stage, I think the Christian model of parenting that basically says, keep them from danger and don't let them know that this is the world they're in, actually, in the end,
doesn't work.
People need to, I think, in the modern world, be kind of taught and made aware of the dangers, the problems. Parents need to talk about those. They need to be honest about those. They need to be helping their children to become wise and make judgments and actually not overreact when their kids make mistakes on those areas, actually to use those as learning opportunities to help them to become wiser.
We're recording something next week.
I was going to say that. It's just in my notes there.
We're recording something with Nathan Weston, who's at Morland's Church in Lancaster, on pastoring in a technological age, and there'll be some wisdom in there on this great subject.
Anything you want to say to church leaders about the CAST report?
I think I want to say that it's very easy to talk about this subject in the abstract and with sort of cold... In terms of cold reality, whereas actually if you've got people in your church or you yourself have firsthand experience of gender issues like this in family or in close connections, then just think, you've got to remember it's very, very painful and very, very personal and often a very, very difficult thing to talk about. So please, please, please do talk about it carefully in church. Just be aware there may be people who are really wrestling with issues you don't know anything about, perhaps a child in the family, and just talk about them in a pastorally sensitive and careful way. Every situation, I think, is different. Every child is unique. And I want to urge some pastoral sensitivity for when we're talking about these things in church, which we must.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I think we can take some confidence and encouragement from the CAST report that actually the services that are going to be provided are, I think, going to be more cautious and more careful. That's a good thing.
And more holistic.
I think that we need to recognise that people do struggle with issues of gender. These are really very deeply felt kind of incongruence between kind of what I'm expected to be and who I feel that I am. And we mustn't downplay how painful, difficult, and hard that is for people to fit in. Often, as the report shows, that's bound up with all sorts of other issues like neurodiversity, other issues of mental health. These are often people in great pain with deeply rooted kind of problems that require an immense amount of care. In fact, in some ways, the kind of report shows that this can't just be medicalized by giving puberty blockers or kind of hormone treatments. The holistic treatment that is prescribed or is kind of recommended is a much more counseling orientated, helping people to come to terms with who they are, what they're feeling. In some ways, it echoes the kind of work of pastoral care and counseling.
Yeah.
And it's a reminder to us that that is actually not a simple work. That is actually a really long-term investment that takes a huge amount of time to help people, listening to them, understanding them, bringing truth to bear on them. As much of the kind of report is about saying helping people to come to terms with how they feel rather than thinking it can simply be resolved by kind of pills and treatment. And I think that is a reminder to us of the pastoral work that we have to do. Obviously, we have the Spirit, we have the Word, we have the truth, but actually in the end, that pastoral care is highly significant.
And there's a seminar at the Leaders Conference in November on shepherding in a sexually confused world, which is broader than this, but is an important topic.
I think another thing that's sort of really interesting in the report is that with many of the girls who present, the evidence is that quite a number will in the end not go through kind of and continuing to transition, although quite a high number of those will in the end resolve as cisgendered lesbians. So there's obviously something going on in terms of people with feelings of same-sex attraction that are being kind of categorized as being transgender. And again, I think that's something we need to be sort of aware of in the church at the moment. I think there's an issue, it seems to me, in the church at the moment as to how we deal with the whole issue of sexual identity, gender and homosexuality. Some wanting to argue almost there's no such thing as homosexuality. There's no such thing as homosexual orientation. We need to abandon that idea. The Bible doesn't speak about it. And although I'm very cautious about the idea of sort of a sexual identity that's sort of some sort of fixed ontological idea, the reality is that people do struggle with desires. Some people struggle with desires that are primarily focused on those people of the same, the kind of same sex. Actually, the Bible tells us that's the case. Romans 1, God hands people over to kind of desires. And I think there's a danger of sort of, in a sense, almost dismissing that as a reality. And I think that could be pastorally dangerous. We need to recognize that often people are struggling with fixed patterns of attraction in their lives. Now, of course, the gospel frees people to live for Jesus, to resist sin, maybe even to be changed and transformed. But we shouldn't quickly assume that this is somehow a bogus phenomena. It's a very real issue that people are wrestling with.
Much pastoral care and wisdom needed. Just to round off for the last couple of minutes, we wanted to talk about the Prime Minister.
Yes, and finally.
And his trainers. So there's Adrian's trainers for those watching the podcast.
This is a fine Adidas high top.
Right.
Rishi has been photographed wearing his Adidas Sambas.
Is that another version of Adidas?
A classic 1947 trainer, wow. In fact. White with blue trousers. He's been roundly ridiculed for it. Not least by the Adidas Samba community. Are you part of that, John? I'm surprised by that. Anyway, not least by the Adidas Samba community, who feel that he is, by wearing them, completely trashed the reputation of this.
That's a bit harsh on the Prime Minister. Whatever your politics are, that's a bit harsh.
I feel sorry for him because he's trying to be trendy, isn't he? And trying to look good. And he's just all come back to bite him, really. And by the way, by putting this on the table, my black and gold Adidas high top with a kind of fleece lining there at the top.
Looks lovely. Like it. Yeah.
I've basically dissed this as a trainer now. I've trashed the reputation of that as a trendy
of
trainer.
This Adidas community as well.
So I've probably offended some people. Mm. It is an interesting lesson just for me in passing. I'll tell you why, Phil. People are obsessed with appearance. Mm. And whether it's Theresa May's leather trousers or, a posh jumper that a US pastor might be wearing in the States or Rishi's trainers, people are obsessed with how people look. I mean, Rishi kind of gets mocked for his short trousers. And even when he was doing interviews, he was asked, why do you wear such short trousers? You know, of all the other things you could ask the Prime Minister of the day, why do you wear such short trousers? It's just a nonsense, really. And we're drawn into it. It's the culture of the age. And I do think how pastors and leaders appear on the outside matters a lot to us. Probably more than we like to admit. And so actually, I mean, I'm always heartened when I go to the leaders' conference and look around and see there's a great variety of pastors, although there's a lot of Czech shirts. Even our producer this morning is wearing a Czech shirt. So I just think we've got to get away, haven't we, from the idea that appearance matters in the sense that God looks at the heart, not at the outward appearance. Mm. And actually, once we begin to evaluate our leaders on what they wear, whether they have a beard or how they speak, or what accent they use, a lot of those things that I thought we'd got beyond. Actually, we're in dangerous territory. Now, we're not dressing to offend. We don't want to be stupid about what we wear or don't. But actually, I think we need to see deeper than that for leaders. So that kind of superficial assessment of leaders, I find quite dispiriting. And it's not just in the world, let's be honest. It's in the church.
Change as well.
And I think there's two sides to that, isn't there? There's on the one hand, the way that we judge leaders, and there's leaders who are trying to create an impression for themselves. Yeah. So at one level, I'd love to know what Rishi Sunak's kids think about his kind of trainers and whether they laugh at dad trying to be trendy.
Just ask my kids what they think about mine,
absolutely. John. So, and I think actually there is a fundamental principle of actually being yourself. Mm. really. Some people could wear something like that and pull it off and it would fit with them and who they really were.
But thank you.
If you're doing it as a desire to try to create an image that everybody kind of really sees through, it's kind of like the pastor who turns up dressed like the kids in the youth group as an attempt to try to connect with them. It could come across as entirely bogus. And I think there's that danger as well. There's that pressure to kind of create an image and to just think that by wearing certain clothes, having a certain haircut or look, you're suddenly going to become kind of someone who can connect. We need to have a kind of an authenticity that doesn't seek kind of sort of image and project a false view of ourselves. So, you know, I mean, in a way, Rishi Sunak's kind of expensive moccasins were far more in keeping
with who we know he is and his life, etc.
This just looks like a bogus attempt to project an image that kind of isn't true.
Well, it is an election year.
Link to the FIC Adidas store will be in the show as well. 5% discount for all FIC members of the Pastors Network.
Excellent. And on that note, we will leave it there. Brothers, thank you so much for thinking thoughtfully and wisely about some of the news stories of the day. This has been Independence, the FIC podcast. Do rate or leave a review so others can find it. And we look forward to talking to you again very soon. Thank you, brothers.
Thank you.